Firstly, can I just say thank you very much for a fantastic film, brilliant footage. Two questions. The first is, are you really suggesting that Stalin had absolutely no interest in occupying Eastern Europe as much of Western Europe as possible?
No.
And it was simply because of the atomic bomb that he did that, firstly. And secondly, you, as historians, know what the Japanese were thinking. You have the advantage of knowing what was happening in Manchuria. What evidence do you have that the man you regard as the criminal in this, Harry Truman, knew the evidence rather than having to make a hard and very difficult political judgment? If it's a judgment question, it's very easy for historians to criticise, but in the heat of the moment, faced by the alternative, he either had to invade with American troops or he had to drop the atomic bomb. Do you know that he and his advisers were aware that the Japanese were about to surrender?
Can we just answer that?
Yes, sure.
Those are pretty loaded questions. So rather than go on to the other things, let me start with the second one, and then we'll get to the first. What did Truman know at the time? Truman was in a very difficult position. He had been vice president for 82 days. Roosevelt had met with him twice and spoke about nothing of substance. Truman's level of knowledge was so low, and people had so little respect for him, that as vice president for 82 days, nobody even bothered to tell him we were building an atomic bomb. That is an astounding fact. Truman was not a well-respected person. In 1934, when the Pendergast machine that runs Kansas City decides to run him for the Senate, the newspapers asked Pendergast, boss Pendergast, why'd you pick Harry Truman of all people? And Pendergast said, I wanted to show the world that a well-oiled machine could take an office boy and get him elected to the Senate. Truman was not some towering figure. In fact, when Roosevelt dies on April 12th, everybody Truman meets with for the next 2 weeks says, this is a terrible mistake. I'm not big enough. I'm not smart enough. I shouldn't be president. We should get somebody who can handle the job. So we're sympathetic to Truman in a certain sense that he had to face the most monumental, difficult decisions with very little background and with all the wrong advisors. So we're sensitive to that. What does Truman know? Truman knows that if you look at the intelligence reports from April on, they say repeatedly that two things. First of all, we know that the obstacle to surrender is keeping the emperor. As MacArthur's Southwest Command says, that the hanging of the emperor to them would be like the crucifixion of Christ to us. All will fight to die like ants. We knew that was it. And his own people in his own War Department and State Department were urging him to tell the Japanese they could keep the emperor. Otherwise, they would not surrender. It was Jimmy Burns who almost single-handedly resisted that, number one. But Truman knew that and was told that repeatedly. Number two, on the question of what would end the war. If you look at the April 11th report of the Joint Intelligence Staff to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, which is repeated in July 2nd, and that comes out a number of times, they say that the entry of the Soviet Union into the war will convince all Japanese that defeat is inevitable. They say this over. We intercept the Japanese cables. We were intercepting them from the start of the war, and if you look at the cables beginning in May, it says that the Japanese Supreme War Council understands that the Soviet entry will deal a death blow to the Japanese emperor. And that's what they say. Now, what does Truman know? Truman was getting briefed on this. Truman refers to the July 18th cable as the telegram from the Jap emperor asking for peace. Those are Truman's words. Truman says after meeting with Stalin, he said, I went to Potsdam for one main reason, to make sure the Russians are coming into the war. After Truman meets with Stalin, he writes in his journal, Stalin will be in the Jap war August 15th. Finny Japs when that happens. He writes to his wife the next day, and he says, the Russians are coming in. Think of it, the war will end the year sooner now. Think of all the boys who won't be killed. We've got evidence after evidence of Truman's attitude. Not only Truman, but everybody around him, because they were reading the cables. They knew that. They knew that, which is why six of the seven five-star generals and admirals who got their fifth star during the war are on record as having said the atomic bombing was either militarily unnecessary or morally unjustified or reprehensible or both, because they knew what was going on at that point. They knew how close the Japanese were to surrendering. And we've got a lot more evidence than that. Read the book. You'll see a lot of the evidence, because we know that Truman was in a difficult position, but we also know that the atomic bomb was not in any way militarily necessary. Let me give you one piece there that you saw. Douglas MacArthur, who we don't think of as a leading pacifist, right? Douglas MacArthur said that the that the Japanese, if we told them they could keep the emperor, they would have surrendered in May, and happily. I think that's a little exaggerated. I don't think they would have surrendered in May, possibly in June, almost certainly in July, if they knew, as people warned, as people said, that the Soviets were coming into the war, that they could keep the emperor, and that we had this horrible new weapon. Now, those three, I think, almost certainly would have brought the end of the war without use of the atomic bomb.
Just a practical point just about dates, because it occurs to me when you really get beyond the skin of events and all the cables, the Americans could not move on Japan until November. That was the operation that was planned.
Right.
That was August 6th, September, October, November, 3 months. We can't lose mass casualties for 3 months. The Japanese are essentially blockaded. The Soviets are already moving on August 9th. They're making fast strides. They wreck the Japanese Kwantung Army, which is almost a million men. That was a huge number. The Soviets were deadly, deadly force, and they had been trained in war, and they were brutal, as the Japanese know. They could see their women being raped. They could see the emperor being crucified. They were killed by, like they did Tsar Nicholas. The Japanese knew the Russians were much more ruthless force than the U.S., so that quick changed their mind quickly to make the deal with the U.S. In fact, Peter points to the fact, I think it's very interesting, that the Japanese didn't even know that they were really nuclear bombed on August 6th because they'd been so bombed by the firebombs over that last 9 months.
Yeah.
Okay, that's... Stalin.
Sure. We don't say that the Stalin occupied Eastern Europe because of the atomic bomb. If you study your history, you'll know that the Soviets were already in Eastern Europe at that point. As John Lewis Gaddis points out, the United States didn't give up anything at Yalta to Stalin that he didn't already have. So the question is, it would be an interesting discussion to get into why we held up the Second Front and how that affected the tide of the war and why that allowed Stalin to progress so as far as he did, as fast as he did. That's another interesting question. Stalin wanted Eastern Europe as a buffer zone. Why did he want Eastern Europe as a buffer zone? Because the Soviet Union had been invaded twice through Eastern Europe by Germany. The Soviets feared Germany more than anything, and they do much longer than that. But if you look at the actual timing of when he puts down these repressive dictatorships in Eastern Europe, most of that doesn't happen until 1947 and 1948. What we're arguing is that there was a period between 1944 and 1946, 1947, if you'd had a different approach toward the Soviet Union, those governments there would have been repressive in Eastern Europe. They would have retained that area. They wanted a buffer zone. They would have been repressive governments, but they do not become lockstep dictatorships until 1947, 1948. And I think the Soviets wanted to, were counting on a friendly relationship with the United States after the war.
And from Greece and the British.
Well,
it's a parallel story.
It's a somewhat different issue, though, because Oliver's referring to the October 1944 meeting between Churchill and Stalin, where they have their 70% here, 55% here, and how important it was to Churchill. He's willing to give up. He says, okay, you can have 75, 80%, 90% influence in Eastern Europe, but I want Greece. And then he later says, Stalin never broke his word to me. You know, he promised this, and he never broke his word to me. Had Stalin been a revolutionary of any sort, he would have supported the resistance forces in Greece. He turns a blind eye to the resistance forces in Greece and lets Churchill reimpose the monarchy there, his right-wing forces.
With force.
Yes,
the
slaughter. As Albert's saying, in the United States in 1944, there was much more opposition to the British going into Greece than there was to the Russians going into Poland.
Okay, shall we take the gentleman in the well here, and then we'll come
dive
forward
in the streets.
To the gentleman next opposite, and then perhaps down to the front here.
Okay, my question is for Mr. Stone. I know you served in the Vietnam War, and you said at the age of 40 is when you awoke to everything that's going on now. I'm 26 years old. At the age of 18, 2 weeks after high school, I joined the Air Force because I had a sense of obligation and duty to my country. 8 years later, I think, is when I fairly awoke as well, after seeing documentaries such as Most Dangerous Man in America, South Border, lots of the stuff you've done as well, and just watching your interviews. Back then, I was oblivious to everything that's going on, and that's the way I think kids are nowadays. I told my cousin, who's actually a history teacher, he should be, you know, showing stuff like this to his students, any type of documentary that challenges our history, but he said he'd get fired. Yet he can have a Marine recruiter go in there and tell, you know, pump them up for war that they shouldn't be fighting or dying for in the first place. How else do you think we should bring this type of awareness to America's youth?
Oh, you sound American?
I'm American, oh. Yes. Yeah.
You want to do three questions?
Well, can we take two other questions before we come back to that? Sorry.
I'm Professor James Woodhouse, and I write for Spiked. I wondered, Oliver, first of all, if I could congratulate you not only on a beautifully spoken documentary, but lots of new stuff with which many people are unfamiliar. I think I would quarrel with you with some of your old categories, military, industrial, and now financial complex, and oil and gas. But I think in the spirit of learning, if I can turn to Peter, I was surprised that you put forward as much as you did the Hiroshima case as being something, a feint against the Soviet Union. I'm familiar with Gar Alperovitz's work on this question, and it's a very familiar concept, like the military-industrial concept complex. And I put it to you that the early part of your film, when you ascribe racial origins to the Hiroshima and Nagasaki thing, could have been given more weight. And I think the wider concept that would be newer and what might take the discussion forward is, don't you think that both Wallace and Truman were in a search for legitimation of America, particularly and American capitalism, particularly at a time when fascism had discredited it so much? And in that cause, Truman wanted to represent Soviet Union as totalitarian and fascist in the Cold War, and Wallace was concerned with legitimation from below, so to speak, to have a peaceful capitalism and imperialism. For his pains, I believe his supporters were baton charged on the streets. But isn't that a chimera? Wasn't he misguided in believing that you could reform such a state at that time? And isn't that quest for legitimacy part of the equation of the origins of the Cold War?
Well, sorry, can we take one more question? And then we'll come back to the other.
I forgot all my good ideas.
Hi. Linking both things out slightly, I thought it was great to see the footage, and I think it's absolutely brilliant that you managed to get Wayne Gow to do the narration. I'm thinking back to the first question there, as regards inputting an alternative history of America into the homes of everybody on a weekly basis now. Is this another way of bringing a war home?
Okay. Sorry, I'll just repeat those three questions. The first one is to do with raising consciousness of old sort of hidden American history in America and in schoolrooms. The second question is about was some of the idealism essentially misguided? And the last question there was about the war is coming home.
Yeah, actually,
it's
individual period in your book.
What war is coming?
Well, each period you... Well, just a question.
It's a sort of like a boomerang effect, I think, we're saying.
Oh, yeah. You're talking about blowback, which I think is
no.
What...
No? No, not good girls, no. I was talking about bringing a war home. You're recreating a history or rewriting a history for people to look at, as it has been done previously. And I'm just wondering if that is a new way in the new millennium, 2013.
I don't understand. Sorry. I'm just saying that... as you're producing a new history, or a rewritten or a reworking of a history, and pointing out its faults with its history, you are now, through CBS or Sky Atlantic or whatever, going to inject that into everybody's home in America. Is this a new way of bringing the war home? This is a form of change, isn't it, that you're trying to instill in American culture, mm-hmm. Same as the young man back there.
Can you answer that?
Yeah.
Okay, can I'd like just to go back to number two for a second. Well, I remember what I was going to say. In the same, my answer, and I only can answer part of your question, I'm going to leave the rest to Peter. We know Gar, we saw Gar the other night too, and he's a wonderful man. And so is Leffler, what's his name?
Marty Sherwin.
What's his name? Marty Sherwin, yeah, he was there too. But listen, you know, you talk about the the way the world worked. And that I was trying to point out about the Hiroshima story, about the, it was 3 months, we were 3 months away from invading. The Russians were much closer. It was scaring the Japanese. I don't think the situation would remain the same for 3 months, because the United States would have ended up having to say, using the Russian troops, helping them to embark into Japan. Because it would have been a lot less, that we would have had no casualties. The Russian army was practically invincible at that time. So why not use the Russians? Why even have one American casualty? That is a cynical attitude, but it makes sense. And it was doable because the Russians were moving. Okay, so that's a very practical solution. You understand? There's no American casualties that are ever going to happen if you let the Russians do their job. Do you understand? We're allies, right? Does that make sense to you? Nothing could happen? Anyway, I'm not going to be rhetorical here, but in the issue of the Cold War, what happened? We had the two sides, whoever blames who, aggressed, raised the noise in the room, and there was this freezing of relations and a lack of communication, above all, lack of communication. It died out. There was no way to get to Stalin. Stalin, there was no way for him to get to Truman. They just froze. And what happened as a result? The Soviets completely froze up on Eastern Europe. They took over eventually. And they made many people's lives very miserable for a long time. It was a desire for freedom. That was a horrible way to end this thing, to end World War II. It froze a huge population in place. What was the other solution? What is the other practical solution? Why did we have to go to that place where we couldn't even talk? I'm saying even maintaining some communication, being angry about this and that, as Rothfeld said, doesn't. All these problems could be solved. Every single one of these problems could be solved. And that is not allowed to be. So here is a case where practical communication, keeping talking to your, not freezing it up, works. And the people of Eastern Europe and the people of America would be a lot better off, because we wouldn't have militarized to where we became an insane, over-paranoid, over-militarized military-industrial complex under Eisenhower so quickly.
There's so many places to jump in. I'll pick up on what Oliver's saying right now. So Roosevelt dies April 12th. Truman's first day of office is April 13th. He meets with Molotov on April 23rd. And in that 10-day period, the relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union has flipped already by that April 23rd meeting with Molotov. Truman later brags afterwards, says, "I gave it to him 1-2 to the jaw." He said beforehand, "I only expect to be able to get 85% of what I'm demanding from him." And he goes there and he accuses Molotov and the Soviets of having broken all of their agreements. He knew nothing about what he was talking about, but this was the Harriman line. Harriman flies back from Russia and to brief him. The cabinet was split on these issues. Stimson and Marshall and others thought that this kind of approach was crazy. But Truman didn't know, and he was making up for his lack of knowledge by this bluster, this bravado, this tough guy stuff that Truman's so guilty of, which backfires. It's just the wrong thing. So what Oliver's saying is we had a period of friendship that could have lasted. We could have worked out the differences, or we could have tried at least. And if we had failed, maybe that would have happened too. But we don't even make the effort. We stigmatize them and we alienate them very, very quickly. Then there's some attempts to move back a little. But the mistrust there is very, very deep. On the question, Professor Woodhouse, in regard to the Soviet issue, if we look at the words of the main advisors on the bomb decision, Leslie Groves, who's chair of the Manhattan Project, Brigadier General Groves, said, "From 2 weeks after I took over this project, I approached it as if the Russians were our enemy, the Soviets were our enemy, not the Japanese." From the very beginning, Jimmy Burns becomes the leading advisor. Burns flies up from South Carolina on April 13th, and Truman says, "Tell me about the world. I know nothing about any of these agreements or what's going on." And he says, "There, I'm going to make you my main advisor from behind the scenes, and then I can get rid of Stettinius. You'll become my Secretary of State." Three leading scientists, Walter Bartke, Leo Szilard, and Harold Urey, went to see Truman. Truman sends him down to South Carolina to meet with Burns. And that discussion was fascinating. Burns says, so Szilard, they're trying to convince Burns not to use the bomb. And Szilard, and Burns says to Szilard, "You're Hungarian, aren't you? Don't you want to get the Russians out of Hungary?" And he starts talking about using the bomb to get the Russians out of Eastern Europe. Right from there, and Burns is the main influence. But the other thing about it was that the Japanese had a really stupid strategy. And that was to try to get the Soviets to intervene on their behalf to get them better surrender terms. And they say in their official statements, if the Soviets come in, we're finished. We're done. So they want to keep the Soviets out of the war, and they want to get, they're going to give the Soviets concessions in order to get better surrender terms. The Soviets had no intention, obviously, of negotiating on behalf of the Japanese. But it's the Soviets who know more than anybody that the Japanese are trying to surrender and are defeated. When Hirota, the Japanese foreign prime minister, meets with the Soviet ambassador, Malik, in Tokyo in May, Malik tells the Kremlin that they're desperate to end the war, that they want to end the war. The Soviets knew that. And so when the Soviets see the United States drop the bomb, they're the ones who immediately say it's dropped on us. Stalin and Stalin's leading advisors know that they're the real target, or believe that they're the real target. And the scientists warned that that would be the case. If you look at the Frank Committee report, so there's a lot of evidence to support the Gar Alperovitz interpretation, which we accept. Now, is Truman, that Truman is so clear-headed? I mean, Truman's confused. This is not a great intellect, really. And Truman was confused about a lot of things during this period. And Truman, on one hand, believes maybe this is going to speed up the end of the war, which he wanted also, without having to let the Japanese keep the emperor. But the irony, of course, is that we let them keep the emperor anyway. And Secretary of War Stimson said, it's in the U.S. interest. We have to let them keep the emperor, or else there's not going to be any stability in Japan after the war. So that was in our interest. But we don't do that until August 10th or 11th, after this all occurs. So from the Soviets have an understanding of what this is, and they have a sense of American ruthlessness, because they believe the war is ending and that this was absolutely unnecessary.
Can I just pick up the other two questions there in terms of alternative understandings of contemporary American history? And it sort of strikes me that, in a sense, that obviously this is a very polemical series that's trying to counterbalance, you know, what is what you see as a very unbalanced dominant narrative. But on the other hand, you know, it is called Oliver Stone's Untold History, and I wonder, in a sense, how do you kind of get past this very polarized society? How do you stop just preaching to the converted, in a sense? Because, you know, the way it's branded, in a way, it's sort of, I would worry that it mainly appealed to people who are already kind of interested in your view of the world.
Well, my view of the world has expanded, and my viewership can expand, too. There's no reason why you cannot reach moderates and people who think for themselves. In fact, I'm very heartened by the reaction to the series. It was unadvertised, and it went out on a premium cable station, but we managed to haul 1.1 million viewers a week, and they hung in there through all 10 chapters. The viewership was as high as at the beginning, and there's a demand for it on demand, and we're also coming out with DVD. We sense that this is a swelling viewership, and we sense all over the world we're starting to go out, the book's going out. You'll see. I'll be back in 5-10 years, and you'll see that it's growing. Like Howard Zinn started much smaller than we did.
Right. And can I add to that?
Of course.
And the book was on the New York Times bestseller list for 5 weeks.
Although it was never reviewed.
not in the New York Times, but it was on the New York Times bestseller list. The documentary is getting out. It is starting to be used in some colleges. We hope to get it into high schools. Mm. But I think, in a sense, you know, they'd wanted the book to be called Oliver Stone's Untold History, and we resisted that because we knew that there were people who were going to say, is this real history or this Oliver Stone's history? And so, and I think that's a mistake in that sense, because this is not Oliver's history. This is all of our history.
That's right.
I mean, this is the history of that's told by progressive forces in the United States. You know, we're not
Showtime that wanted my name above the title.
Yeah.
And you know, thinking a bit like Alfred Hitchcock. Okay, you got to why would anybody watch another history program? I suppose that's what they're thinking. So you give it a little bit of an allure. So we played that game, I think, on the film, but on the book, we left it off. Right.
It's not on the book.
Yeah. on the film we did.
And we discussed it because we knew that that was potentially problematic, because we want this. I mean, this is, there's been a lot of good historians and a lot of good work, and we're standing on their shoulders. You know, this is something that's based on the top American scholarship, or what we consider the top American scholarship from our vantage point, of the past 3-4 decades. Now, we see it like Howard Zinn. Howard Zinn was very enthusiastic about our project. And we see, we're actually, people who put out a comic book version of Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States are working on a comic book version of The Untold History. We want to reach as many different kinds of audiences as possible.
Thank you. I think we should come to questions in the center of the well, if we've got our 2 roving mics, and we'll take 3. And they really have to be short questions to the point, because we are running very close to time.